Hi there, Jeb Sharp here with How We Got Here, the history podcast from PRI's The World. The World is a public radio program about all things global. It's co-produced by the BBC, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. It is February 2nd, 2011, and this is the first of what I hope will be several episodes of How We Got Here, looking at the historical context for the events in Egypt and elsewhere in the Arab world. Thank you to everyone who's written in with questions. They're wonderful. I've had queries about everything from Gamal Abdel Nasser, about the Suez Crisis, about the leadership of the Egyptian military, the role of the Muslim Brotherhood, the place of women in Egyptian society. We will try to tackle all of it. This first conversation, which runs about 20 minutes, is with Michael Wahid Hanna of the Century Foundation. It's an overview of the broad strokes of recent Egyptian history, starting with President Hosni Mubarak and the context in which he first came to power.
Well, he's a military man. He was the head of the Air Force during the 1973 war, which was seen as a heroic moment for the Egyptian military and for Egypt. There were military gains made in October 1973 against the Israelis. So he fits the pattern of military leaders who became president. His two predecessors were Anwar al-Sadat, also a military man, and before him, Gamal Abdel Nasser, who led the Free Officers Movement and established what was at the time a military state, and in fact perhaps a military society. Under Mubarak, it moved away from outright domination of all aspects of governance by the military, and they were a less public presence in Egyptian daily life. But they still played an incredibly important role in being the silent guarantor, so to speak, of the regime. But they took a step back, and Mubarak was very conscious, I believe, of trying to lower the public profile of military leaders. But he obviously is one of them, and they still, obviously, as we see now on the streets of Cairo, are still a very essential component of the Egyptian state structure.
And when we talk about it in those terms, what did that military grow out of?
Well, you know, in 1952, Gamal Abdel Nasser led there's some historical debate on this. Some people will call it a coup as opposed to a broad-based social revolution. But this was a group of colonels within the Egyptian army. This was a movement against the then king, King Farouk, and the remnants of British imperialism. Although there was a revolution in 1919 against the British, there were concessions made and British troops were still stationed in and around the Suez Canal. And Farouk was not seen as not seen as fully sovereign. There was parliamentary life, but again, it precluded and confined by the continued British presence and the king. And so this was sort of the establishment of this regime. This is the sort of the forerunner for where we are now. And Abdel Nasser took a line of Arab nationalism, and this became the credo of the regime. And Egypt became sort of the central focus of the Arab world. And part of that mission was the conflict with Israel. And along those lines, the military grew in importance as wars were fought. Obviously, in 1956, there was a war of attrition. 1967, most problematically for the Arabs. But this is sort of the bedrock of the regime, and this is how the army came to play such an important part in the Egyptian state.
And whether it was a coup or a social revolution, how popular was the army back then and the regime that grew out of those changes?
It was popular, particularly in the early days. As the regime wore on, Nasser became more oppressive, cracked down. He cracked down on the Muslim Brothers, who made an attempt on his life. Many leftists to the left of him. I mean, he was represented Arab socialism, so to speak, and was a leader in the non-aligned movement. But he feared those to his left. And so as the regime matured, it definitely became less popular. It was perhaps at times more popular in the Arab world. Abdel Nasser was a fantastically famous figure throughout the Arab world, and people waited to hear his speeches, and he transfixed the entire region. Obviously, 1967 was the big turning point for Nasser, the crushing defeat to the Israelis in the Six-Day War and the loss of Sinai. And, you know, that's a critical moment in Egypt's history and the history of the region. And really, you begin to see many of the trends of disillusionment and stagnation that followed. Many of those things were ongoing and underway beforehand, but 67 accelerated many of these trends.
And what are the roots of the relationship between the United States and Egypt, and specifically the kind of aid the United States has given Egypt for so long?
Well, it started even before Camp David, with Anwar Sadat sort of playing between the Soviet Union, which had backed Egypt traditionally, and the United States. And Sadat, and along with his economic reforms, moved quite decisively to the orbit of the United States and the West. This was obviously cemented by the Camp David Accords with Israel and the aid program that was set up by the treaty in accordance with the accords goes back to 1979 to the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty.
And when you look at Mubarak and the relationship with the United States and relations with Israel, what's important over the 30 years of his rule? What to you are the key chapters of that period?
Well, with respect to Israel, with respect to Camp David, it's been a treaty that has been respected. Sort of the core of this treaty is non-aggression. Egypt had been the main military foe for the Israelis. These wars had taken a dramatic toll on Egypt and Egyptian society. And Egypt could no longer bear the costs and the burden. It could no longer fight these wars on behalf of the Arab world. It has not been a warm peace. It has been more, it has seen, witnessed more close relations of late. That has been out of step with Egyptian public opinion. But it has often been described as a cold peace. There has not been the sort of cultural normalization that the Israelis had hoped for. And obviously that is contingent at this point on a settlement of the Palestinian question. And Egyptian society has shown a great reluctance to move in the same direction as the government has in many instances because of the lingering questions about Palestine and the increased polarization over the occupation.
And how much are relations with Israel and with the United States part and parcel of what's happened with Mubarak's relationship with his own people?
Well, this is not, if you see the demonstrators in the street, you will notice that foreign policy has not played particularly large. This has been mostly about their lack of dignity, the repression they've suffered under the state, torture, disappearance without charge, illegal detention, economic malaise, political stagnation. There's a whole laundry list of complaints and woes. More recently, we've seen food inflation, and this has been really, these are the causes, the fundamental causes of this latest really stunning development. And obviously, there is some concerns in Egyptian society about the direction of Egyptian foreign policy. And part of that, I think, is that Egypt has become impotent on the regional stage. It has become a defensive-minded regime. In recent years, it's been solely focused on issues of regime survival. And Egypt, which was once the leader of the Arab world, is now, has basically subcontracted out its foreign policy to the United States. And I think much to the detriment of our relationship to Egypt. Egypt is no longer a particularly useful ally for the United States anymore. They have no regional weight. They've been eclipsed by the likes of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and even Qatar in some instances.
So when you look at the protests and what's happening, it sounds very much of now. Things have gotten to a point where people can't take it anymore. But are there historical strands beneath the surface that matter here in terms of where we go next?
Well, you know, analysts and observers of Egyptian politics have long warned about the dangers of potential instability in Egypt. And the day has never come. You know, for some of us, we had long ago assumed that it would not come. There had been a certain stagnation. And what would look like a recipe for social instability had never tipped over into anything broad-based. There has been protest, there has been political opposition, but it's been tightly constricted, and it hasn't reached across social strata and united the populace like these latest events have. And so it's something that lots of people have thought could happen, but in some ways Egypt had given off the image of stability, of a stable oasis, despite. But these causes have been underlying and have been growing, and obviously the events in Tunisia and the New Year's Eve bombing of a Coptic church all, I think, had a big role in galvanizing public unity and creating a demonstration effect. And for whatever historical reasons, things tipped over finally. But for some of us, I think it seems as if it's been a long time coming.
And if there's a power struggle now, who will be the players?
Well, first and foremost, it's the people. It's the demonstrators on the street. They have made clear that they have certain demands, that they will not be easily bought off. They won't be mollified by what are pre-orchestrated and sort of feeble attempts at the appearance of reform. Obviously, the military is perhaps the other big player now. They've indicated that they understand and recognize the legitimacy of the grievances of the people in the street. And they've also indicated, perhaps more importantly, that they will not turn their guns on the people. The security forces attached to the Ministry of Interior were overwhelmed by the demonstrators. And the regime would have fallen if it were not for the army restoring some semblance of order. However, the regime can only survive now if the army throws its weight behind it. That would require, I think, it using force, and it's indicated that it's not going to do that. So I think pretty clearly, assuming that the demonstrations and the protests continue, I don't think there's any way for this regime to survive.
And what's the best way to think about the Muslim Brotherhood and the role of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egyptian society and politics and also in this moment?
Well, they have a long history, obviously. They were brutally repressed by Abdel Nasser. And of later years, they gave up the notion of political change through violence and accepted the notion of democratic norms, participation in political life. They have also been outlawed. They are banned as a party currently by the Mubarak regime. They have run in parliamentary elections as independents, and they are the most coherent opposition force in Egyptian society. As other political parties have been repressed as well, they have retained a form of legitimacy that I think is in keeping with regional trends where Islamist thought has been on the rise. That being said, they have been out of step with this current protest movement and the uprising, and they, I think, were caught by surprise. They've been very cautious players, and there is a sense that, you know, they are somewhat out of step with the very non-ideological emphasis on national unity that we see out on the streets in Egypt. And reports confirm that when the Brotherhood has tried to tip the sloganeering and chanting into religiously based chants, they've been drowned out, and people have told them, no, this isn't about you. This isn't about the Brotherhood. This is about Egypt and Egypt's moment and a moment of national unity, perhaps a moment of national unity that Egypt has not seen since 1919.
I know a lot of our listeners are intrigued by the role of women, not only in the protest, but in Egyptian society. Can you help us with that a bit?
Well, I mean, we should think of this, you know, this is not Afghanistan. Women have long played a role in public life. Schools are filled with women. You know, obviously, there are gender imbalances and inequalities in Egypt as the rest of the Arab world, and they are not represented in political life in a proportional sense. But they're there, and they're a presence, and they've been a vocal presence out on the streets. And they have a very high public profile in this demonstration movement. There are not as many women as men on the streets, but they are a definite presence.
I mean, I guess part of what's interesting about a moment like this is that you could take many indicators, but you could certainly take women and really track what happens in what comes next.
This isn't a society, you know, women work outside the home. There are women doctors, women lawyers, women professionals. Again, perhaps not in a proportional sense to their, it's not 50% of the professional of the professions, but women are a very vibrant part of this movement and have been for some years now in the sort of predecessors to this, the protest movements that have that had previously galvanized some of Egypt's youth.
Michael, what fascinates you most about this moment? You know, just what's really gripping you, striking you, confounding you?
Well, Egypt plays a special role in the Arab world. I mean, it is the most populous. It has previously dominated culture, music, radio, television. It was the region's political leader. Al-Azhar is the most renowned, perhaps, Sunni house of learning. It's a university in Cairo. And so changes in Egypt have a disproportionate impact on the rest of the region, and particularly in the wake of Tunisia and the very stunning developments there. I think there will be spillover effects from this. I think there is no way that that is not the case. The Middle East has been, particularly the Arab world, perhaps the one region in the entire world that has not seen any democratization. It has been surpassed by East Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa. And I think much to our own detriment here in the United States and damaging to our own national security interests. I think radicalization in the region has grown from and out of these repressive regimes. And so this is a moment, I think, of great hope and opportunity. I know that there is a lot of apprehension in the United States and I think, frankly, some scaremongering. But in fact, if we can establish a precedent of vibrant political pluralism in the Arab world, that's got huge demonstration effects because this is Egypt. This is different. Tunisia was hugely important as a catalyst. But in terms of lasting impact, it's hard to understate how important this could be for the region. And obviously that means we have to get the transition right. The Egyptians have to get the transitions right. And the rest of us in the international community, to the extent there is a desire for it, we should be there to support this because I think it's a very important moment of transition in the Arab world.
That's Michael Waheed Hanna of the Century Foundation. Again, I'm planning more episodes on all of this. If you have questions you'd like answered, I'll try to get to as many as I can. Please post them on the How We Got Here webpage at theworld.org/history. Again, the world, one word, .org/history, or you can post them at the How We Got Here Facebook page. And if you prefer, you can email directly howwegothere@gmail.com. And finally, you can also tweet me, and the handle is @JebSharp, one word, JebSharp. Thanks for listening, and I hope to speak to you again soon.